or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Ken Kuminski, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 15th and 16th issue of the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. First article, our obsession with conspiracy theories is human. So is the cure. Fiction is the most powerful tool we have to combat the unreality constantly spun online, writes the best-selling novelist David Balducci. For the armies of conspiracy theorists who march among us, times have never been so good. Politicians and governments are pushing misinformation that comports with their views. Chatbots hallucinate. Propagandists proliferate. And enormously wealthy individuals who live in such a unique bubble, they might as well dwell on Mars, are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to manipulate an electorate already staggering along in the face of competing realities. Shovel in the fact that some conspiracy theories have turned out to be at least semi-plausible. Cue the drip-drip of UFO disclosures, and you have fertile soil for sprawling, kudzu-like growth in the business of manufactured truth. The ubiquity of such fabrications does not make it any less dangerous to a democratic society, but perhaps it changes our plans for what we create to deal with. Before science came along, mythology was part of how we made sense of the natural world. Thor for thunderstorms, shrieking sirens to explain shipwrecks, the abduction of Persephone, the reason behind the bleakness of winter. We have mostly evolved from that with the help of science and technological progress. Yet something inherent in the human psyche still pushes us fiercely toward the rabbit warrens of outlier theories. Myth-making is still a large part of how people understand the world, even if they now apply it to suspicions about the powerful institutions and advanced systems they no longer trust. I know this as a novelist, one who often probes my own mind for outlier theories. I have received many fan letters over the years that note my fiction can read like nonfiction. It's not necessarily by design, but I do believe to effectively assemble a thriller, a writer must contemplate all that is possible in the present to realistically construct what dark, fearful deeds are plausible in the future. Some of the plots of my earlier novels would seem quaint today. In The Whole Truth, which I wrote 23 years ago, an arms contractor, eager to start a new war to profit from, hires a talented manipulator to convince people over the internet that a horrible crime with dire global implications has taken place. What's changed since? The Whole Truth was published is the efficiency and quality of the delivery of misinformation. For every fact-filled story written by seasoned journalists, almost anyone could release an armada of chatbox accounts based on vaporous, cockeyed beliefs, dressed up enough to look like facts. So much so that even the most cynical among us is in danger of being duped. Add in the ever-growing quality of deep fakes, and it has never been easier to not only distort reality, but also to establish one's own beachhead on it. It's as if the entire information ecosystem has been jumbled by an overactive imagination. This is not a problem for animals. They can detect coming danger like earthquakes or floods because their senses deliver facts. A sound, a smell, the change of the wind. They cannot be convinced that such devastation was caused by a group of power-hungry maniacs in some bunker who are cloud seeding with zeal or remotely detonating a nuke in the San Andreas Fault. Yet it is precisely because the human mind can override both natural and common sense that we thrive, innovate, and build. Our capacity for imagination is arguably what sets us the most apart from other living things. Perhaps we are fighting information collapse and societal fracturing with the wrong weapons. Arguing about facts doesn't deter outlandish ideas, misinformation, or AI hallucination. Maybe more storytelling, more imagination, more fiction is what's needed to combat the unreality spun online. After all, there's a reason dictators burn novels. This is, of course, a theme of Ray Bradbury's classic Fahrenheit 451, published in 1953. In the book, most homes have parlor walls with huge video screens that broadcast streams of babbling commentary for both entertainment and manipulation. The point is to dissuade people from reading and shorten their attention spans. The actors in the videos are to become the people's new friends and idols, such that forming relationships with friends and family is no longer necessary. A nonstop pipeline of carefully controlled information, as well as people to look up and listen to, is deemed by the leaders behind this fictional authoritarian society to be the best way to control the people. And if that doesn't ensure the populace is in thrall to the authoritarian narrative, the firemen of the novel burn books, ensuring ideas can't get into the hands of the people. I don't mean to say that fiction is a substitute for a good education, but at our best, we novelists probe deeper truths precisely because the facts cannot always ever be totally known. The idea for my 2022 novel, The 620 Man, came from the Panama and Pandora Papers, document leaks that laid out how trillions of dollars could be floating around the world, hidden from view and taxation by elaborately designed shell companies and other financial and legal skullduggery. Any good novel will put you, the reader, in the shoes of different characters. You suffer and you cry with them and also experience their joy, their challenges, their ambitions. No story is truly finished until the last reader inhabits it, because we all put our unique imprimatur on any novel. The words are filtered through each reader's own individuality. In that vein, the imagination, as shaped by fiction, is not focused on what divides, but rather on what unites, even if the story depicts acts of brutality or oppression. The plays of Shakespeare will always be relevant because he wrote of human beings in both their elemental goodness and darkness. And though we may evolve as a people, we also remain the same in many ways. Folks today often act like their predecessors did during Shakespeare's time. That is not necessarily a bad thing. It is a badge and connection of our inner humanity. No matter the strengths of AI, a chatbot cannot dream up stories with flawed characters and themes and arcs and failures and triumphs with ambiguous finales. They are mashed together databases to sense patterns and retrieve verbiage. Imagination only comes into play when someone takes a message from a chatbot and uses it for action. Of course, AI can ape us and create things based on our patterns. That's sort of the whole point. I am currently a plaintiff in a class action lawsuit against OpenAI and Microsoft due to their unauthorized use of my and many other writers' works for training their large language models. Yes, the AI community determined that superintelligence can be achieved most effectively by reading lots of books. Who knew? The very best novels will never try to explicitly sell you lies as the truth or narrative as dogmas. Of course, many do have themes and messages that are overt or that spark reactions in the masses. Uncle Tom's Cabin, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and To Kill a Mockingbird are just a few examples of this. But none of these novels were set up to deliver a set of facts. A novel makes you think and imagine why a storyline might be right, or not, or both in some ways. And then, and this is critical, it makes you reach for another book, and thus more to think about. In addition to bestowing upon us the greatest of all human attributes, empathy, books also compel us to read in ever-widening circles. A well-read person grows body armor against the rigid conspiracy theorist, against flat artificial intelligence that manipulates without emotion. It is no coincidence that humanity shot forward when Gutenberg invented his printing press. Books are super fuel for the human mind, the mightiest intellect on earth. And right now, that intellect needs all the collective nutrition it can find. Next, why is everything pickle flavored now? A deluge of sour, briny snacks has infiltrated the market. Blame Gen Z by Olivia Hugh. Pickle flavored ramen, pickle infused beer, pickle spiked Sauvignon Blanc, pickle zested ice cream? A certain flavor profile is exploding. It's sour, it's briny, it's huge on social media, and it's coating everything in its path. Never in my life would I imagine cotton candy with pickles, said Chris Dubois, senior vice president of the Fresh Food Group at Circana, a market research company. We're just in a golden era for pickle flavoring. In the past few years, nearly every snack food giant and retailer has piled on the trend, and for good reason. Pickle-flavored items are hot. According to Circana's data, such snacks grew 30% in sales over the past year, compared with 3.8% in the snack category overall. It's the same for ones not traditionally fermentation forward. Pickle-flavored trail mix grew by 10%, as opposed to 4% for the general category. Some of this growth may come from the influx of new pickle-flavored items, but companies keep releasing them because existing products are selling so well. Whole Foods began selling Daily Crunches Dill Pickle Sprouted Almonds in 2024, and within a year and a half, the product has seen 812% growth, the firm said. PepsiCo released its Flamin' Hot Dill Pickle Cheetos in 2025 and made them a permanent offering this year after the company said it had become the fastest selling limited edition flavor in the brand's history. Flamin' Hot Dill Pickle Puffs followed with a rollout that featured Megan Thee Stallion and Nickelback. Retailers say one group is fueling the trend, a cohort they're most eager to capture, Gen Z. Last summer, Hormel Foods, the company behind Spam and Skippy peanut butter, cited Gen Z, the ultimate target market for snack brands, as the inspiration behind the launch of Dill Pickle Corn Nuts, Dill Pickle Cashews, and Dill Pickle flavored Hormel Pepperoni. Gen Z is a fun generation when it comes to food, Dave Anderko, Consumer Insights lead, said in an interview. It's not just that they're drawn to intense, savory, sour seasoning. They're willing to try a lot of different things. It all started, as many things do, online. Viral TikToks of outlandish pickle combinations have flooded the internet in the past couple of years. One trend centered on the chamoy pickle, a hollowed-out jumbo dill pickle typically filled with spicy chips or sour candy, coated with the Mexican condiment chamoy and wrapped in a fruit roll-up. All you have to do is take a bunch of pictures of people biting into something going, "Ew!" And that creates a whole lot of excitement, said Dubois of Circana. Plenty of the taste testers who went viral seemed surprised to find they actually liked the flavor explosion. The pop star Dua Lipa set off another viral wave of taste testing when she posted an October 2024 video on TikTok where she added pickle juice to her Diet Coke. That contributed to the popularity of other DIY pickle-infused drinks, including pickle lemonade, pickle margaritas, and this summer, white wine with frozen pickle slices. Consumer research firm Nielsen IQ found that this year unit sales for pickle-flavored mixers were up some 140%, and sales of pickle-flavored spirits grew up by 10%. Pabst Blue Ribbon released a limited edition pickle beer in collaboration with Grillo's Pickles this spring. Gen Z itself is capitalizing on the trend. Yasaman Bakatar, 27, and Leah Marcus founded Good Girl Snacks in 2023 when they noticed pickles were becoming to Gen Z what avocado was to millennials. Bakatar said they branded their hot girl pickles to resonate with Gen Z shoppers, with eye-catching packaging and a strong social media presence. Whole Foods began selling hot girl pickles in September 2025. They come in garlic, cumin, and honey harissa flavors. Novelty and shock value are a big part of the sell, said Andrea Hernandez, a food trend forecaster and writer of the Snacks Shot newsletter. Getting that attention on social media, that is piquing people's interest, especially the younger generation. Ryan Lucas, aka the pickled guy on social media, understands this. The 45-year-old IT professional and content creator has an audience of over 600,000 people across his social platforms where he posts pickle-related reviews. He recently tried out the newly released and sold out Mr. Bubbles Dill Pickle Fluffy Foam Soap. "Am I going to buy it because I want to bathe in a pickle?" "No," said Lucas. "I'm going to buy it just because I want to see what it's like." You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The time is about 18 minutes past the hour. Next, a lost civilization is baffling experts and rewriting China's origin story. The otherworldly beasts and enigmatic masks of Sanxing Duai still enthrall decades after the unearthing of ceremonial pits. By Jonathan Chang. In Guanghan, China, in July 1986, workers at a brick factory in southwestern China were digging for clay when they hit upon something unexpected. Dozens of dazzling pieces of jade. The chance discovery led to one of the greatest archaeological finds in modern history, one that continues to thrill China with its ornate gold masks, towering humanoid figures, intricate 12-foot-tall bronze sacred trees, sculptures of fantastical beasts, and hundreds of elephant tusks. The artifacts from Sanxing Duai as the site is known, stirred questions that still perplex experts four decades later. How could a civilization boasting gold and bronze masterpieces, jade working, and silk production disappear without leaving written records or human remains? Why did that civilization appear to have systemically smashed and buried its treasures in ceremonial pits? The mysteries surrounding Sanxing Dui have spawned even more outlandish questions. Do the enormous protruding eyes and enigmatic smiles featured on the figures suggest the ancient people were extraterrestrials? The puzzle only deepened with the discovery in recent years of six additional ceremonial pits full of shattered artifacts. Even the basics about the ancient civilization at Sanxing Dui, located in the modern-day province of Sichuan, are fuzzy. It appears to have flourished roughly 3,000 years ago, boasting splendors even more exquisite than those of China's heralded ancient dynasties. The striking features of Sanxing Dui's humanoid figures, so un-Chinese in their appearance, have prompted a wholesale rethinking of what historians thought they knew about the origins of Chinese civilization. Perhaps it didn't emerge solely from its traditional cradle in the Yellow River Basin, and could other advanced independent civilizations have also flourished within China's current borders before their subjugation? China's ruling Communist Party has stepped in to quash any heretical notions. Chinese leader Xi Jinping, who recently blessed a sprawling new expansion to the Sanxing Dui Museum, has presented the findings as evidence that China has always enjoyed unity and diversity within its modern-day borders, and therefore that Beijing is a legitimate ruler of Tibet, Xinjiang, and other regions not primarily populated by China's dominant Han people, who account for more than 90% of the country's population. In the past 5 years, Sanxing Dui has captured the imagination of a Chinese nation eager to revel in its long history and civilization accomplishments. Sold-out exhibitions of the Sanxing Dui treasures have crisscrossed the country. Their images have exploded in Chinese pop culture, appearing in video games, animated films, and collectible bobbleheads. Chinese civilization is both mysterious and incredible, said Fang Qing, a 33-year-old real estate professional from Changsha, who posed for pictures with an oversized Sanxing Dui plushie during a visit to the site last month. Some people speculate that it involves aliens, but I view it as a civilization in its own right, although we do not yet fully understand the nature of that civilization. New splendors unearthed. Ron Hong Lin, the lead archaeologist at the site, had long believed there was more to Sanxing Dui, whose name means three-star mound, a reference to a nearby topographic feature, than the two sacrificial pits found in 1986. In December 2019, Ron's team uncovered an ancient Chinese ceremonial vessel in what would later be identified as sacrificial pit number 3. I actually jumped for joy, Ron 39 recalled. Unlike in 1986, when many of the artifacts, especially the elephant tusks, decomposed after being exposed to the open air, Ron improvised a new system for the dig. The archaeologists built sterile, temporary structures with temperature and humidity controls and lowered experts clad in head-to-toe medical gowns into the pits atop bed-like platforms so as to minimize contact with the artifacts. In the above-ground labs, they used artificial intelligence and digital technologies to resemble the millions of shards into recognizable forms. The unearthing of the six new ceremonial pits confirmed some theories that Ron held. For instance, that the pits were all likely dug at the same time, with pieces of the largest sculptures scattered among the various pits. But the new discoveries also reaffirmed old mysteries, such as the lack of a writing system or human remains, and raised fresh questions. Some of the buried objects had been burned so thoroughly as to defy explanation, while the abundance of gold, far more than can be found in China's traditional Yellow River Basin, has perplexed experts. The apparent absence of weaponry or tombs, including for the civilization's rulers, also remains a mystery. Tristan Brown, a professor of Chinese history at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, places the Sanjing Dui discovery in 1986 alongside the discovery of the Terracotta Army in 1974 as two moments that reshaped how China regarded itself as the country entered the post-Mao Zedong years. But whereas the Terracotta Army outside modern-day Xi'an reaffirmed China's self-conception as a powerful civilization centered on the central plains where it has long traced its origins, the discovery of Sanjing Dui, an equally advanced culture nearly 500 miles to the southwest, in hard-to-reach Sichuan, challenged that narrative. It puts a different face on Chinese civilization, Ron said. If we didn't have Sanjing Dui, the picture we would have of China would be very different. With only about 1/600th of the Sanjing Dui site excavated so far, we know that the work at Sanjing Dui won't be done in this generation. It will continue and require future generations to carry on the work, Ron said. And now from the books review section, Paul Simon's African Tunes, Days of Miracle and Wonder by Ashley Kahn. Review by David Kirby. It's 1984 and Paul Simon is ready for a change. His previous album, Hearts and Bones, 1983, has not lived up to his label's expectations. He's been shuttling between Manhattan and Montauk, New York, on Long Island, where he's building a beach house he intended to share with his second wife, Carrie Fisher. But as the house is going up, his marriage is crumbling. Fortunately, he has some upbeat tunes to listen to. Someone sent him a bootlegged cassette of Maba Kwanga, a type of South African dance music that reminds Mr. Simon of the three-chord pop hits of the 1950s. Mr. Simon is already familiar with the music of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, a 10-member a cappella Zulu choir known for its bass-heavy harmonies. The more he listens to the cassette, the more he likes what he hears, and the more his spirits rise. Lenny Waronker, at the time the president of Mr. Simon's label, Warner Brothers Records, later recalls that the singer had just figured out a way to do dance music his way, and dance music was so powerful in those days. Mr. Waronker tells Mr. Simon he should start working with Nile Rodgers, the producer behind hits by David Bowie, Madonna, and others. But Mr. Simon has other ideas. The lackluster performance of Hearts and Bones has freed him. I can do whatever I want, he thinks, and what he wants is to go to South Africa. But there's a problem. Memories of the Soweto uprising of 1976, in which an estimated 600 people protesting South Africa's apartheid system were killed, are still fresh. In 1980, the United Nations General Assembly passes a resolution calling for all of its members to prohibit cultural exchanges with South Africa, though its vague language presents a challenge, given that cultural expression takes so many forms. Mr. Simon has no intention of performing in South Africa, but he is aware of the sensitive nature of his desire to record there. So he seeks the advice of industry professionals, including Harry Belafonte, who advises him to go. Belafonte offers to put him in contact with the leadership of the African National Congress, the principal opponent of the apartheid regime. And with that, Mr. Simon is off to Johannesburg with his longtime producer, Roy Haley. As described in splendid detail by Ashley Kahn in Days of Miracle and Wonder, the next 1.5 years see a total reinvention of Mr. Simon's way of writing and recording songs. On no previous album had he focused so completely on starting with rhythm and harmony tracks and adding melodies and lyrics later. More importantly, on none had he collaborated so completely as he did here with other musicians. In Mr. Kahn's words, Graceland would become the most ambitious all-in gamble of Mr. Simon's career. Mr. Kahn, a music historian who has written books on John Coltrane and Miles Davis, was a member of the Graceland tour production team. Here he connects the making of the album to politics, the music industry, and the individuals involved like no other book of its kind. Mr. Simon bonds with the South African musicians immediately. They were used to being treated badly by record executives in their own country, as well as by visiting musicians, but even before he arrives, Mr. Simon lets them know they would be getting paid triple the American Union scale. Right away, we were treated really first-class, man. First-class, bassist Bakithi Kumalo recalls, they bought us lunch. At Ovation Studios in Johannesburg, Mr. Simon works with musicians from 3 bands, eventually choosing Mr. Kumalo and 2 others to continue recording with him in New York. For the South Africans, that trip includes their first passports, their first flight on a plane, their first time leaving their country. And culture shock, at one point in New York, Isaac Mutshali, the drummer, asks, "When do we have to go to register with the police?" For his part on Graceland, Mr. Simon transitions from what he calls ordinary language to enriched language that let the words tumble this way and that way. If you compare the steady march of a trademark early Simon and Garfunkel song such as The Sound of Silence, 1964, with You Can Call Me Al, 1986, the breakaway single from Graceland, the difference is striking. The earlier song is brick-by-brick construction of a bleak urban landscape, whereas the latter one is a verbal hurricane that almost makes sense, or at least it makes enough sense. In Mr. Simon's own words, the lyrics would come by you so quickly that all you would get was a feeling. The album's Very Little remains a bit of a mystery. Originally, Mr. Simon wanted this record to be global rather than focus on American culture the way his earlier songs did. So why name its title track after Elvis Presley's fabled Memphis Home? Initially, he thought of the name as a placeholder, but it wouldn't go away. Eventually, he realizes that he doesn't mind the emotional shadow that Graceland and Elvis casts over the song. In some way, I think it adds an emotional punch. The album becomes everything the musician and his label could hope for. It wins the Grammy for Album of the Year, and led by the ubiquitous radio play of the bouncy single, You Can Call Me Al, earns the number 2 Billboard spot for LPs and cassettes sold and number 1 for CDs. Yet controversy dogs it. The term virtue signaling has not entered the common parlance yet. But on U.S. college campuses and elsewhere, Mr. Simon is confronted by protesters accusing him of defying the UN ban. His defenders include Angelique Kidjo, a singer and politician exiled from her native Benin, who views the album and subsequent tour as part of the movement that came around to get Nelson Mandela out of jail. Oliver Tambo, the president of the African National Congress, tells Mr. Simon, "We love you. You're a brother, and you have our respect, and you're welcome here." Fittingly, the art on the album's cover is a 15th century rendering of a knight on a quest, and the outcome of quests are notoriously unpredictable. There was almost a Don Quixote feel to it, recalls one Warner Brothers executive. He could be on his way to Graceland. And as a reminder, you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The time is now about 35 minutes past the hour. The next review, Inventing the Documentary, How Film Became History by Thomas Doherty. Written by Peter Tonget. On a visit to Berlin in February 1933, Cornelius Vanderbilt Jr. wrote about his impressions for Script magazine. "Germany today is a fortress. Everywhere are troops." Despite his family's immense wealth, Vanderbilt aspired to be a journalist, but he did more than write. "While mid-European," he later reported, "I took movies, some with sound, of that tribe called Nazis. Got some riot stuff, some terror, marching and burnings." Once back in New York, Vanderbilt tried to marshal his movies into a coherent film. Hitler's Reign of Terror, 1934, ended up a conglomeration of Vanderbilt's recordings, repurposed archival footage, and some shabby reenactments, among them a scene depicting an interview Vanderbilt supposedly conducted with Hitler, as played by an actor amid poor set decorations. As Thomas Doherty explores in How Film Became History, Vanderbilt's well-intentioned effort is an early instance of what we know today as the archival documentary. Mr. Doherty, a film historian and professor of American Studies at Brandeis University, points out that there are many shortcomings in Hitler's Reign of Terror. In that reenacted interview with Hitler, for instance, Mr. Doherty tells us that in the background is a sign reading in incorrect German, "Hitler spekhut abend," "Hitler to speak tonight," and an amateurishly painted swastika. But the film also incorporates real footage, including what the author describes as one of the most cinematically hypnotic expressions of Nazism preserved on film. The May 10th, 1933 book burning outside the State Opera House in Berlin. Audiences today expect copious amounts of historical footage and documentaries about recent history. Whether the subject is World War II, the Beatles, or the life and times of a modern president, most documentary filmmakers depend on the repository of moving images that has been growing since the invention of motion pictures more than 100 years ago. But it wasn't until the 1930s, with the passage of 30 or so years of documentation by the motion picture medium, Mr. Doherty writes, that a sufficient backlog of footage had accumulated for filmmakers to create a new kind of film, one stitched together from footage from older films. Vanderbilt didn't have such a wealth of footage to draw from, but in using what he could, Mr. Doherty notes, he certainly earned more than a footnote in motion picture history by creating the first U.S.-made feature-length anti-Nazi film. As halting and awkward as they may have been, early archival documentaries required considerable advances in cinematic technology. During the initial years of the motion picture, cameras, for example, were too cumbersome to capture anything but a scheduled event, Mr. Doherty writes. Soldiers marching in formation and funeral processions were picture perfect for the technological limitations of the medium. The notion that motion pictures could make a record of real-world events was formalized with the advent of the newsreel, the creation of which is credited to the French studio Pathé in 1910. the release of a predictable and dated issue in the manner of an edition of a newspaper or magazine, Mr. Dorey writes, marked a decisive turning point for film as a medium committed to recording the events of the day. The form quickly spread to all countries where movie making flourished. Several years later, World War I served as the force multiplier for newsreels, which benefited from cameras becoming smaller and lighter, and newsreel editors and cameramen more professional. The breakthrough of talking pictures introduced the voiceover narration, a revolutionary development that allowed for further context to be added to historical footage. This innovation was greeted with awe, if not mystification, by audiences at the time. The invisible narrator was the formal term for the disembodied speaker, Mr. Dorey tells us, but audiences, uncertain initially of the whereabouts of the visitation, called it the ghost voice. The feature-length archival documentaries, Mr. Dorey describes in detail in his book, are not high-profile titles. It would take years for the techniques they pioneered to be perfected. Even so, filmmakers reveled in the potential of extant footage to summon actual history to life. Take the case of Lawrence Stallings and Truman Tally's The First World War, released in 1934 by the Fox Film Corporation and described by Variety as a celluloid anthology of the world's greatest wholesale slaughter. As Mr. Dorey tells us, tens of thousands of horrors of hours of film already existed at the time, produced by the U.S. government-run Division of Films. But some of the footage had been deemed so appalling that it was never screened during the war. Mr. Dorey writes that the cameramen knew what they photographed would never be used in official films, but they did not stop cranking. In 1933, Stallings, a writer and World War I veteran, who drew attention to the horrors of war through projects such as the feature film The Big Parade, 1925, teamed with Tally, a Fox Movietone news producer, to recover some of the footage that had been stowed away in vaults in France and America. Although Mr. Dorey notes that the exposure of footage heretofore unseen by U.S. moviegoers was especially coveted, he emphasizes that the film endures not only for presenting raw footage, but by organizing it into 11 chapters overlaid with voice-over narration. The First World War was judged a major achievement. There have been several assemblies of war films from the archives, wrote Terry Ramsay, himself a journalist who had attempted to make a World War I documentary, but none so comprehensive or well-prepared and correlated. Max Eastman and Herman Axelbank's Tsar to Lenin, 1937, traced the end of the 300-year-old autocratic rule of the Romanov dynasty, Mr. Dorey writes, and followed the transition to an even more ruthless dictatorship. Axelbank owned the most extensive trove of Russian-themed footage held outside Moscow. Yet it was Eastman, a far-left writer and activist, who found in Berlin's Soviet trade embassy home movies of the Romanovs, some taken by the Tsar himself of the royal family at play, and most remarkably, scenes of the Tsar swimming nude with his courtiers. Alas, the film's politics were divisive even among its intended audience. Eastman's editing of these pictures, the Daily Worker wrote, distorts the history of the period in a manner calculated to play up the activities of Trotsky and the other traitors who were tried and condemned at the recent Moscow trials. Still, there was something boldly new in the film's use of decades-old footage. Tsar to Lenin marked a tipping point, Mr. Dorey tells us, in how the past would be apprehended in the future. This fascinating book is a study in how archival documentaries in the 1930s lurched forward from episodic newsreels to hodgepodge feature-length efforts. Vanderbilt's film on the Nazis' depravity was judged by Variety's critic as incredibly lacking. As a film production, it's poor and doesn't rate as entertainment, but in its own way, Hitler's Reign of Terror and other such early efforts birthed a new form that remains with us today. Together, Mr. Dougherty notes, the film inventory and the expert commentary created the archival documentary, the motion picture genre that preserves and rewinds our history. The next review, what's the point? Early instances of written language were lists. Ancient scribes needed a way to indicate where a reader should stop. On the Mark by Florence Hasrat. Review by Megan Cox Gurdon. The success of Mark Kurlansky's 2002 microhistory Salt has given rise to a great profusion of narrative nonfiction works that have as their starting point an ordinary thing. An author then ranges across disciplines to show how consequential in human affairs the ordinary thing has been. Thus, we've had microhistories of coal, sugar, rain, dust, cotton, butter, notebooks, eating utensils, and bookmaking. Now, here is Florence Hasrat with On the Mark, a thoughtful and lively history of punctuation. Subtitled From Periods to Interrobangs, How Punctuation Remade the World, the book explores the evolution and effects of the small markings that writers have used for more than four centuries. One surprise here is that no new bit of punctuation has gained a purchase in English language writing since about 1600. The interrobang of the subtitle is a mashup of the question mark and the exclamation point that a New York ad man tried to popularize in the 1960s. It's a cute idea, an emphatic, eye-rolling interrobang, but there isn't any need for it. As the author remarks, question mark, exclamation point, or exclamation point, question mark, has done that just fine for a long time. Ms. Hasrat, the author of An Admirable Point, A Brief History of the Exclamation Mark, 2022, begins in Mesopotamia some 5,000 years ago, when scribes used reeds to press triangular markings into clay tablets. The writing, known as cuneiform, lacked punctuation as we know it. The early Egyptians used some punctuation-like symbols in their hieroglyphs, but it was not until about 3,000 years later that a librarian at the great scroll house in ancient Alexandria introduced dots as a means of distinguishing the beginnings and ends of sentences, and the clause breaks or pauses within them. Aristophanes of Byzantium is known, therefore, as the father of punctuation. According to Ms. Hasrat, Aristophanes' dots were the first non-alphabetical marks devoted to unlocking sentence structure and therefore enabling the performance of text. The notion of performance is important. For people of the distant past, words on the page were there to be read aloud. Even today, when the custom is to read silently, there remains an element of performance. As we string groups of words together in our heads, resting and resuming, we take in almost unconsciously the little signposts of punctuation that give shape and rhythm to what we're reading. Early punctuation focused on the contours of the sentence, giving us the comma, colon, and period, Ms. Hasrat writes. Later innovations introduced elements of narrative texture and tone, as when the question mark entered the repertoire over the 8th and 9th centuries. The exclamation point arrived in the middle of the 14th century, bringing what many felt was a welcome infusion of emotion onto the page, and was joined over the 15th century by parentheses and the apostrophe. The ampersand, meanwhile, evolved over time from a jagged bit of Roman graffiti into the curly charmer we know today. Each additional symbol brought the opportunity to bring greater refinement of rhythm, feeling, and clarity to the written word. As Lynn Truss reminded us in Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, 2003, the placement of a single comma may radically alter the meaning of a sentence. When it comes to this aspect of punctuation, Ms. Hazrat gets a little dour and eventually almost becomes unglued. For soon politics will enter her story. Punctuation troubles our notions of control and authority, she warns, of identity both individual and collective. Ms. Hazrat points out that the punctuation of William Shakespeare's plays seem not to have come from the bard himself, but from the editors, copyreaders, typesetters, and publishers who shepherded his manuscripts into finished form. But it is but a short step to her complaint, not wholly unjustified, that modern editors associated with Folger Shakespeare Library added exclamation points to the speeches of Cleopatra and somewhat less of Antony in the tragedy bearing their names. Antony gets his emotionality added in situations of heroic masculinity, we read, whereas the same marks cause Cleopatra to be racialized as the exotic, seductive, and overly emotional other from the magical East. Whether the added punctuation has the effect of the author imagines, she's not wrong to point out that editorial decisions, once made, tend to stick, informing how future readers will interpret a story or character. But then we go whizzing off into the land of political grievance, where a hyphen in the phrase Israel-Palestine conflict suggests a failure, in the author's view, to hold apart the colonizer and the colonized. Scare quotes are reprehensible when used by oppressive authorities to cast doubt on the legitimacy of, say, the presidency of Barack Obama, but laudable when applied to the war on terror, which we read has actually been a lawless bombing campaign across several countries in the Middle East. And speaking of politics, did you know that Joseph Goebbels hijacked the punching power of the exclamation point in Nazi propaganda to excite crowds and to push Adolf Hitler to greater heights of linguistic megalomania? Well, he did. Guess what other politicians has in more recent days exploited the exclamation mark? You are wrong if you guessed Jeb or Lamar or Jesse or Rocky, but right if you named that reliable bugaboo in the White House against whom so many writers on every subject seem to feel they must declare themselves. Ms. Hazrat, who argues that the U.S. Constitution ought to evolve according to our current attitudes, not least to remove a notorious comma relating to gun rights, treats the subject less as an analyst than as an activist, making her left-leaning allegiance clear. Punctuation can be an amazing springboard for discussions, she writes, as long as we translate the results into real action in law, work, allyship, and social cooperation. Having discharged her blasts of febrile political static, which detract from the merits of the book, the author turns to punctuation in the digital age. She explores the use of the hash mark, a symbol dating back to medieval times, as a modern means of expressing irony online. She eulogizes the emoticon, that conglomeration of punctuation marks that English language texters used to convey feelings before the arrival in 2010 of the emoji. And she concludes with a slightly confusing lament for the way things are going, with communication substantially taking place online. Sadly, digital punctuation serves corporate greed and questionable political interests. There's a lot of good in On the Mark, but the whole is marred by Ms. Hazrat's determination to enlist her subject in service of her political beliefs. Punctuation marks do matter. Their presence is eloquent, and so is their absence. What's tiresome is that in learning about them, we have to sit through a one-sided lecture of the usual dreary sort. Here's a quick review of the book Propaganda by Edward Bernays, 1928. 10 years after World War I, a decade during which governments began to mobilize public opinion on an unprecedented scale, Edward Bernays offered Propaganda, a remarkably frank guide to mass persuasion. Bernays, a publicity consultant who pioneered the idea of a public relations campaign, opens his book with the claim that the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Propaganda, he argues, could be a tool to regulate and benefit the body politic. It advanced causes he favored. He notes that activists for women's rights, armed with what he called the weapon of propaganda, had made their influence felt on city councils, state legislatures, and national congresses. But even if Bernays was sanguine about the use of propaganda, his own enthusiasm points at its dangers. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society, he writes, will become an invisible government. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 15th and 16th issue of the Wall Street Journal Review. We read from the Wall Street Journal Review every Thursday at 7 p.m. Your reader has been Ken Kuminski. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the New York Times. At 9 o'clock, we have Harper's Magazine. And then at 11 o'clock, we have episode number 7 of Dada of Egypt by Marie Benedict. Stay with us. If you or people you know shop at any of the Dash's supermarkets, please save Dash's register tapes for radio reading. Our agency receives $2 for every $100 in Dash's register tapes. Radio reading has raised thousands of dollars so far. Anyone can drop off their Dash's tapes to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 1199 Harlem Road, Cheektowaga, between William and Clinton Streets. Or Dash's tapes can be mailed to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 1199 Harlem Road, Cheektowaga, New York, 14227. Any questions on Dash's tapes for radio reading? Call us at 716-821-5555, and thanks for caring. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability.